This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
I just want to say a few things about the book and the process that I've been kind of going through. I didn't really always start out thinking that I was going to be writing a book about this kind of big story about whiteness in America. The project actually came to me when I was doing a series of focus groups in Tennessee around this story of the Affordable Care Act. This was in about 2012, 2013, when a guy named Trump was kind of a nuisance on social media, but nothing more than that. And the issue in 2012 and 2013 in Tennessee was there was this debate about, like, was the Affordable Care Act going to become the law in Tennessee? Were they going to adopt these healthcare exchanges? Were they going to expand Medicaid, which was going to help a lot of people? And a couple of colleagues of mine and I were doing a series of focus groups in these low-income housing communities, and we were talking largely to African-American and white men. And we would ask people, we didn't ask them, how do you feel about Obamacare? How do you feel about the ACA? We would say, who benefits from healthcare reform, among other questions? And it was really interesting because when we would talk to the African-American men, they would be like, health insurance is great. It helps everybody. As a society, we want to get more people insured because we want a big safety net. I mean, that was kind of the standard answer. When we would ask these white men, and it was pretty powerful if you think about it, we were in these low-income housing communities, really, really medically ill men, who benefits from healthcare reform? And the story that kind of sticks out to me the most from this whole project was a story of a guy who I call Trevor in the book, who came in a walker because he had such an inflamed liver that it was too painful for him to, he couldn't walk normally. He couldn't breathe really well. He had oxygen right here. This guy needed medical attention. I mean, he really was on death's doorstep in a particular way. And this is a guy who would have benefited from not just himself having better medical care, but having a system in his state where the system itself was functioning better. And, you know, we had the group, we kind of BS'd around, talked about blah, blah, blah. And then when I asked the question, so who benefits from healthcare reform? What we heard was he would say, look, I know I need help. I know I need medical help. I'm going to die an early death just like my dad did. But I want to tell you, no matter what you ask me, there's no way I'm going to support Obamacare because, as he said, quote, there's no way I want my tax dollars going to Mexicans and welfare queens. That was his quote. And that was kind of the intro quote. And I remember just thinking at the time, on one hand, of course, this is hugely problematic, racist, all these kind of things. But here you would think if anybody was going to accept the Affordable Care Act, it would be a guy who's like on the threshold of death in a way. And so I remember talking to my research assistant who was helping me with the group afterwards, and I thought, man, on one hand, this is a really old story about just what white racism in the South stands like. But think about the power of this ideology where this guy is literally lying down on the tracks, and this guy actually did pass away over the course of our two-year project, literally lying down on the tracks rather than accepting a program that might be beneficial for him. And so the power of racism, call it that, the power of ideology, the power of this conservative messaging that people were telling him. And so I just remember thinking, like, this is remarkable, right? Because it abuts many of the things that I had heard in medical school, which of course is, from an evolutionary perspective, the preservation of life is the strongest thing propelling us forward, and things like that. And it turns out, gosh, there's something that's even stronger than the preservation of life, which is screwing over other people in a way. And so this became this jumping off point. So from that, I started kind of looking around for other examples as this project played out. And I guess the question was, what are the examples in which white politics, white nationalist politics, white identity politics, whatever, are at odds with white longevity in a way? And so first we finished up the Affordable Care Act part, and it turned out all the data that I uncovered as part of that project was pretty much remarkable. It turned out that across the state, it wasn't just this one guy, this one group, this one housing community. It turned out that what happened was this was a bigger politics in which the entire state rejected the healthcare exchanges, the Medicaid expansion, all these kind of things. So these politics that we found in the room tied to many bigger politics, the bigger politics of rejection, the idea that basically we don't want your exchange. And what I found in the data part of the project is when this linked to public policy, independent of how anybody felt, when you lived in a state like Tennessee and you rejected the Medicaid expansion, for example, the entire healthcare system started to fall apart. And in the data part of the project, I ended up finding out that that on an aggregate level cost every white citizen of the state 2 to 3 weeks of life. Now, people on the lower end lost more, people on the higher end probably didn't lose any, but across the board, because this health system was failing, people were paying, every white person in the state paid about 3 weeks of life. So what are 3 weeks of life worth, right? And that's kind of one of the existential stories. What's 3 weeks of life worth? You could adopt a system that's gonna work well for everybody, like the African-American men told us, or you can have this fantasy that you're going to block other people, Mexicans and welfare queens who are taking away resources, dollars, healthcare resources. But it turns out there's a boomerang effect. It's really, really bad for them, but it also shortens your own lifespan. And so that became kind of the organizing principle of the book. And I started telling different stories about how this particular politics, a politics that I call racial resentment, it's anti-immigrant, anti-government, pro-gun politics that has been present, of course, for centuries in the United States, but it took on a particular life, you know, when Obama was president and with the 2016 election. And that after the healthcare part, I ended up going to Missouri. And I talked to people about guns in Missouri, which is a whole other different story. But again, hear this rhetoric of guns. I would go around and ask people. I went to NRA meetings. I went to support groups. I went to all these things. I talked to politicians. And I'm like, why do you have guns? And people would tell me these incredibly racialized stories. It would be like, well, Ferguson's happening, or black people are going to come steal my big screen TV, and all this kind of stuff. And they were living in these areas where they're like, honestly, it was like a big bucket of rice. I mean, there was only white people for like 300 miles, you know, and Ferguson was nowhere near what was happening. But this idea that somebody was going to come in, I got to protect my house, I got to protect what's mine, I got to protect my stuff, whatever. And this ideology became to the point where a lot of the people that I spoke with, they had guns under their beds. They had them in their headboards. They had them on their nightstands. It turns out what happens when you have guns in those places, well, you're not shooting an intruder. You're at risk of partner violence, accidental shooting, and suicide. And so it turned out in these areas, white suicide rates soared. I mean, they went up like 300%. And it wasn't part of the news. It wasn't getting covered. And what I did in the book was I just tracked this story of why is it that these symbols of white defense, which is what people told me guns were, what happens when you turn those on yourself? How do people narrate it? And then again, it became a data story. So I just tracked the aggregate life lost of pro-gun policies that ended up leading to a lot of guns in very pro-white areas. And again, the numbers were astronomical. I did a lot of kind of public health, data analysis, and it turned out this cost I think the number was 12,000 white male quality of life years, 12,000 years when you started aggregating all the life years lost. It was this huge, huge number. And again, here's a place where it would have been better off to just say, how can we promote safety so we all trust each other? How can we do all these things? But instead, this gun motif became so powerful. The last part, again, another story, is I went to Kansas. And Kansas is this place that has this remarkable history of education. When I was growing up in Kansas City, the Kansas public schools were number 6 or number 7 in the nation in reading and science, reading and math in 4th and 8th grade exams. Everybody loved the public schools. All of a sudden, around 2008, 2009, 2010, all these libertarian, GOP, Tea Party kind of politicians came in, and Sam Brownback, the governor of Kansas, was the most prominent. And what they start doing is cutting away money from people, cutting away money from roads, from bridges, from schools, the schools that were so great. And I went around and talked to people in Kansas as this started happening. And what happened was the Kansas public schools that had been in the, 5, 6, 7 in the country, all of a sudden they fell to 43rd, 44th in the nation in 4th and 8th grade proficiency. And also what started happening is people started dropping out of high school. Lots of people started dropping out of high school because there weren't support services, there weren't all these kind of things. Now, I would go around and I would ask people, do you support these tax cuts? And they would say, I mean, some people were like, yeah, I support small government, I'm pro-business, I can get down with that. But then other people would tell me, well, we were paying all this money and the black districts were taking it all and they were buying party buses with all the money. And so I would go to the black districts and I'd be like, do you guys have party buses? And they'd be like, dude, we cannot afford textbooks. Like, what are you talking about? But there was this myth that minority and immigrant populations were wasting. And this was such a powerful story that it ended up people cutting funds that ultimately cut money for their own, I'm not kidding, look in the book, their own kids' schools, and they still supported the tax cut. And I did a data analysis of this, and it turns out when you drop out of high school, it shortens your life expectancy by about 5 to 7 years for a number of reasons. That's because you have a worse job, you don't have health care, you da-da-da-da-da, all these things. So high school dropouts have shorter life expectancies. And I just added it up, and it turned out in Kansas, the cost of these particular politics was, again, about 13,000 to 14,000 quality of life years, a huge number just in the first 4 years alone, because Kansas, most people who go to public school are white, because it's an 86% white state. And so, again, this politics that was supposed to be something that influenced minority districts or minority people ended up boomeranging, and not just boomeranging, but all of a sudden, in many instances like Kansas, white populations suffered the biggest health consequences because they were influenced the most by this. And so that's why I call it dying of whiteness, because this ideology of a kind of zero-sum game, winner-take-all relationship to race, I felt like was driving white Americans in the Midwest and the South to make decisions that were bad for everybody. I mean, I don't want to understate this, and I can't overstate this enough. They were really bad for black and brown people, for sure, really, really bad. But they were also bad for everybody, because it turns out we're all connected. All these systems like healthcare, education, roads, we're all connected. And so it turned out to boomerang back on them. And so that's kind of led to this idea of dying of whiteness. And I started thinking, like, on one hand, and I'll just leave with this, and then I want to kind of begin our conversation. But I would say that there's this fantasy of a kind of wake-up narrative. In other words, like, part of the reason I think this book has spurred a certain conversation or participated in a conversation is because I think there's this sense, you know, we hear a lot of times, gosh, Trump voters, they're voting against their own economic interests. They're voting against their own whatever interests. And we hear that a lot. But in my book, what I'm trying to show is they're also voting against their own biological interests, right? They're voting against their own lifespans. And so there was this idea, would Trump voters or whatever, and I don't mean to castigate Trump voters. I mean, I'm from the Midwest. I live in Tennessee. But it's more these politics, when these politics of racial resentment work their way into health policies and everybody suffers. The idea was this would become a wake-up point, a wake-up moment. And it turned out what I found was the more dire things got, the more people supported these politics, not rejected these politics. And so the idea that people were going to wake up when they saw, and you can think about it now, like, you know, soybean farmers are getting destroyed by these tariffs. They become more desperate, right? They become more pro-Trump. After a mass shooting, people become more pro-gun if they were aligned with guns. And so, in a way, these moments of extreme tension, these moments of extreme, you know, you lose sight of the fact that you created the problem in the first place, and it creates people, you know, like that. And Dorothy and I were talking on the way over here, and she said, well, the fantasy was when white people saw that it was just taking years off their own life, that would be the wake-up moment. But I think that's the question, is kind of what is the wake-up moment that we're thinking about? What will it take? And is that even that a goal? Now, I'll just say three things finally, just quickly before we start our panel, and that is, you know, I think a lot about this wake-up thing, because I think that part of what I've come to realize on one hand is I don't think it's the job of liberals to go down and change Trump voters' minds, which I think was the fantasy when I started. I think this idea of at least illuminating that there could be a possible progressive movement from conservatism. I mean, I think that might be something that might be a changer. You know, when people start saying, yeah, I'm pro-Trump, but I also deserve healthcare and education or something, that might be something. But I do think that we're living in this profound moment of irrationality, you know, in a way, and people aren't deciding based on these kind of factors. And I guess the other point is really about whiteness, right? I mean, I also, in writing this book, have grown frustrated by the fact that Donald Trump gets to co-opt this narrative of whiteness in this country and define whiteness in a way that is incredibly, you know, guarding the boundaries against other people who are gonna, you know, do this thing. And it's like the worst demons of whiteness in a particular way. And so I also think that it really challenges white Americans to start speaking out a bit more about what it means to be white in America today, about what it means to have our narrative of whiteness co-opted by this incredibly problematic narrative. And so I do think that part of the other issue is calling whiteness what it is at this particular moment, and not just about whiteness itself, but as I've tried to show in the book, the issues themselves, like healthcare, guns, and education, and other issues, the issues themselves have these profound racial histories, and that's part of what gives them the racial charge, and we need to be more open about it. And so I guess the last question is just like, if we're talking about race, what does all this mean about white America? And so with that, I will call up my two good friends here, and we can have a conversation, and then we can all get depressed, and then we can all go drink afterwards.
I don't know, Dorothy, if you want to start off by saying a few things before I launch in, because I have a lot I want to think about here, and a lot I want to ask. But I guess the question is this. Maybe just, when you talk to people, did they really realize that they were not going to have as long of a lifespan because they valued this idea of whiteness that they had? I think that's the biggest question for me when I read this book. It's like I'm trying to figure out, I'm like, is whiteness something, white supremacy probably is the better way to put it. Is white supremacy something that you want to hold on to so much that you'll lose 3 weeks out of your life and you can still feel sort of good about yourself, but you're dying? Like Trevor, I mean, I read about Trevor and I just thought, wow. Like, you hate what the black man gave you so much in affordable health care that you would just rather die.
You want me to answer that?
Yes.
Well, it's funny about this question of how to define whiteness. And part of the reason I called it whiteness, I mean, I talk obviously about white supremacy a lot in the book. But part of the issue is that these were, I think it's, so again, partially it's a policy question, right? Mm-hmm. The whiteness wasn't in, I mean, some people who I talked to were unbelievably racist, and I think because I was a white man talking to them, they felt
comfortable.
They felt really comfortable talking to me. They didn't know I was a spy. But so I think part of the issue is that that some people were racist, but most people either didn't espouse overt racist ideas, or I genuinely believe, and I talk about a lot of examples of this at the end of the book, a lot of people actually weren't racist, right? They were actually really upset by what was happening in their state. They were basically saying, we have a social responsibility to immigrant communities and stuff like that. Like, people were saying stuff that was, to my ear, incredibly not racist. I've actually met some remarkable people, but the risk wasn't so much about the person. It was about the policy, because the risk was that they lived in a state where no matter what their positions were, they had elected politicians, the majority of people had elected politicians who then went in and enacted these policies. Like in Tennessee, for example, they repeatedly voted in politicians who their main platform was, I'm going to deny healthcare for people of color. I'm going to deny expansion. Like, so in a way, the risk wasn't about anybody's individual attitude. It was about the policy. And in a way, that was, for me, was the most powerful issue, because I didn't actually, I mean, I did engage with people's individual level racism, but I didn't, in a way. It was more like, okay, here's the policy. And for me, there's something a bit more optimistic about that, if you will, because I figure if it's the policy, then we can, policy seems much more changeable than identity in a particular way. Dorothy?
But the problem with that is that what your book shows is that the reason we have those policies is because of investment in whiteness. So the African Americans that you interviewed, they all got it. They got that policy is good for people. You know, equitable policies like healthcare for all are good for everybody. that makes a better society. They get what a lot of researchers are showing, that the healthiest societies are equal societies. And I'm you know, amazed at how brilliant and knowledgeable that these ordinary African American people are, that they got what a lot of sociologists, you know, get PhDs in and spend lots of time proving, that it's good for a society to be equitable. That improves people's health, and everyone is happier and gets along better, and it's wonderful. Okay, but so why don't we have policies like those in the United States? And a number of researchers have shown this. I think your book shows it, how deeply embedded the racism is, that it not only prevents policies that would be better for everybody, but white people are willing to die, so, you know, to have bad policies. So then to say, well, we just need to change the policy, I think it's the reverse, is how in the world are we going to change these policies when it's, you foreclosed in your book every possibility. I mean it. It's like airtight white supremacy. We're willing to die for it. You can't change our minds with evidence. Educating people isn't going to do any good. It's not because of ignorance. So teaching them, giving them the facts, isn't going to make any difference. It's stronger than preservation of life itself. You know, it violates evolutionary principles. You know, how deep this investment in whiteness is. And it's longstanding. You show it comes from slavery, and it's continued generation after generation after generation until today. It's not just poor and working class white people. Even middle class white people and liberal white people are invested in whiteness. And so, as you were saying, we're talking about what's the wake up moment. It's like there's no wake up moment. Like, this is a nightmare that we're going to have forever. And I guess what I'm wondering, what is the answer then? Because the policy can't change as long as white people refuse to change those policies, because they don't want people of color to benefit from them, and they're willing to die rather than have them. You can't change their minds in order to change the policies. So where do we enter in? What's the next step?
It's
Do you
funny.
Know what I mean?
Yeah,
that's
great.
What's the
that's
next
great.
Step?
There have been a lot of reviews of the book, and one was, it's long on diagnosis and short on prognosis. And I thought, well, yeah.
Scary,
because I said, like, what's, yeah. you know, so that question of what to do about it. So I want to.
Yeah, it's not a criticism of the book.
No,
I think the book is all true. It just leaves us in
this
position. Yeah.
So I'll say a few words about this, just riffing on some of these points and doing that open conversation. And one is just to disprove this idea that it's about education, right?
Yeah.
So because I will say, if you go down to the South, for example, and interview people about the Affordable Care Act, they know way more than people in New York about how the Affordable Care Act works. So the people who were rejecting the Affordable Care Act, there was no illusion that if I gave them like a pie chart about this or anything like that, so there was no illusion about, I mean, they knew what they were doing. Mm-hmm. So that part was, there was no illusion about that. And so I do think for them it was about, I don't, you know, lowercase p or principle or something like that. But it wasn't about education. So everybody keeps saying, well, what if we just educate? But I don't see this as an education.
Yeah.
And that's why it's a book about whiteness, right? Because it's about a construction of race. The die narrative is complicated. And the reason about this die narrative is because, okay, here's whiteness, here's whatever. But there, within this category of whiteness, there's something very interesting happening, particularly about GOP politics, that I think is important to highlight.
Mm-hmm.
And what that is that there's a contract, an unspoken contract, between basically white elites. And if you hear Du Bois and what I'm saying, it's because it's no different than what we've been having since Reconstruction and before. But basically, there's a contract, right, in which white elites benefit. So they're not dying of whiteness that much. Corporations are not dying of whiteness all that much.
Yeah.
And then here are these working class and lower, poor people.
Mm-hmm.
And they're saying, as part of my white identity, as part of my wage, as part of this, I'm willing to forego healthcare. I'm willing to destroy the schools. I'm willing to have crappy roads where there are more car accidents. And part of why that is because there's this identity, Republican identity, white identity, conservative, Trump, whatever, call it what it is, but that identity is more powerful. Now, if you think about that, this contract is what keeps the GOP platform in place. Yeah. And the reason I say that is because the minute the people at the bottom, again, thinking of Du Bois, start saying, well, gosh, I'm Republican, but I want better friggin' roads. I want health care for my kids. I want better schools. The minute the poor white people start saying that, the entire GOP platform collapses because they can't do their most important thing, which is give tax cuts to rich people. But they can't do that. So there's an assumption, even within conservative politics, about the that white bodies, these idealized supreme white bodies, that white bodies are disposable, right? That working class white bodies, because white bodies have to be disposable to support the GOP platform. And so in a way, I don't mean to turn this also into a class story, but it's like there's a contract that's happening. Yeah. There's a contract that's happening here in which, you know, you have to have white bodies that are in the hundreds of thousands getting thrown, cast aside, or the GOP can't give the tax cuts, right? And so this narrative of dying is racialized, it's class, but it's also a contract. And the interesting thing is everybody's agreeing to that contract. Yeah. You know, that's the scary part, is everybody's agreeing to that contract.
Everybody white is agreeing to it.
That's what I mean.
Black folk want to get out of that.
No, what I'm saying is everybody in the system is agreeing to that contract, which is just goes back to Du Bois writing about after Reconstruction, you know, and that kind of thing. And on the other side, you know, I'll just say, how does health insurance work? The African American men we spoke with, they didn't just understand the function. And in the conclusion of the book, I write about you know, exactly this literature. Yeah. But it's also that the African American men also really understood how health insurance works. Like the most people buy into the system, then some people are sick, some people aren't. You know, one person's whatever. And so part of what I started to understand about white resistance to the Affordable Care Act was, really deep down, they didn't want to be in the network with black people. They didn't want to think that my health decisions, that I might be sick and some healthy black person is going to have pay into the system and support me. There was something about this social web where everybody was connected that just as a metaphor was so powerful because it's like when you think of a net, it's like we're all in the net. They didn't want to be in the net.
It goes to something even deeper when you say that. It actually goes to this idea about American exceptionalism and individualism. Because if I don't, you know, they don't see themselves as connected as a whole. They see themselves as individuals and exemplars in this space that they are in, right? And so it's easy for them to say, I don't want to be connected to those black people in the system or anybody else's health because I should be taking care of myself or, you know, I should do this, right? Yeah. And that the government shouldn't do this. So that's one thing I see, and and I'll ask you to comment on that. But the second thing I see that was really interesting to me is that there's a sense in which you said that, oh, I don't think those people are racist, right? The ones that you talked to towards the end of the book, right? And I'm thinking, well, yeah, they kind of are, because basically what they want is they want everybody to aspire to the ideal of whiteness, right? And the ideal of whiteness is you don't have to do all this stuff. You pull yourself up by your bootstraps. You don't, you know, your health care is your own responsibility, or if you have a good job, you have it, but it shouldn't be the government taking care of it. And so they've bought this Republican line, right? But not knowing that it's on top of their white bodies.
Yeah.
And that, to me, is the interesting piece. And then one last thing, and I'll ask you a comment. I'm curious because what I kept thinking about when I was reading this book is I'm thinking like a historian, and I'm like, well, what about 100 years ago? What about 50 years ago? I mean, I know this is like maybe, you know, since 2008 that they've thought about this because you had a black president. But can we go back in time and look at this and say, have white people just been dying all the time because they've just been mean? I'm sorry, I didn't mean like that.
But, No, I think it's a good. So those are great questions. I'll start with the individuals point. If you don't believe me, just I did a remarkable hour-long talk show on NPR, Minneapolis Public Radio. Yeah. Those guys are awesome.
Yeah, they're
and
great.
A really good show. So I did one last week, and it's on. It's the website is dyingofwhiteness.com, and all the press is on dyingofwhiteness.com. There's a press tab. And I posted this thing, and people were calling in, even from Minnesota. I mean, come on. And they were saying, I'm an individual, I'm a bootstraps person, and I don't want to be forced to buy into the Affordable Care Act because I'm saving up money for when I get sick. And, and I'm like, what do you do? And they'll be like, oh, I work a, you know, work at 7-Eleven. I'm trying to go back to school, stuff like that. And they're all saving money for when they get sick. And I'm just like, have you actually ever been sick? Because that is not going to last very long. But there's this idea of, there's this idea of, which is, you know, think about like when the, Al Gore versus Bush, when Al Gore said, it's only the top 1% of wage earners are going to be, and every, like 90% of the country thought, I'm a top 1% of wage earners. So it's that kind of thing. There's this delusion about just how much stuff costs and what it means to save. But it's also about like that time when you get sick or when you get old, that's when you want a social network, right? That's when you want the most, you should be out on the street with a sandwich board telling people to sign up, because the more people that buy in, the more help you're going to get. So there's this individual mentality, I think, is so problematic. And healthcare is the perfect example, right? It takes a network. It takes a network. But but this idea of the network not you know, not buying into it, I think was good. This thing about whiteness, I guess, and maybe this is just me trying to come up with this question of what to do about it and struggling with it, right? But I guess I just kept thinking there are other models of whiteness. There are models, religious models of whiteness that talk about taking care of people in need and immigrants, whatever. And I know there's race. I'm not trying to say they're not racist and stuff like that. But what I guess I just would, I would encounter people who were deeply religious or deeply whatever, deeply, you know. So I just kept thinking, like, I just kept thinking about, are there other models of whiteness other than the one that's dominating Trump's America right now? And is there some way to talk about those or something? Because we have been co-opted. I mean, again, it's been there for 100 years, but we've been co-opted by the most stereotypical, other people are taking away your shit narrative. And what's interesting about that narrative is, like for example, I'd be talking to these guys in these housing communities, and like their lives sucked. But their lives sucked not because people were coming into the country who were really poor and taking away their stuff. Their lives sucked because really wealthy people like were taking all the money from the system because of these tax cuts. But nobody was ever looking up. They were always looking down. And so there was no way to get people to look up. And I kept saying, like, well, what about corporations? Right. And they'd be like, yeah, corporations. And then again, of course, this is a story that is very old. And that's partially why I have all the history in the book to say that. But I would say that there's something very particular happening in the United States right now, which is, you know, we've faced this in the United States for a long time, but there is something about when these very fringe positions come into this halls of power in states and what happens to population level health. And then when these policies become, you know, Betsy DeVos and the NRA buying the Supreme Court, all these things, these are fringe positions that are taking over the mainstream. And so I think that's what we have to worry about right now.
You know, this idea of individualism, when the question about why does the U.S. have the stingiest health care and other forms of public welfare systems of anywhere among Western democracies? Why do we have the biggest prison system? You know, why do we have more of the bad stuff and less of the good stuff compared to European and Australian and Japanese, you know, every advanced democratic system, advanced if you want to call it that, the U.S. stands out. And often the argument is, well, we've got this individualist ethos in America, but why do we have that? Again, I think we have that in America because of white supremacy. So white supremacy is enabled by an individual. It produces and is enabled by a very individualist philosophy. You can't separate them, because that whole idea of the individual who makes it on their own, that comes out of, you could say, colonial America, as far back as you want to put it. There was slavery back then. That was part of the justification for slavery, was the idea that individual white people were innately superior to every black person. And those ideas continue to circulate. I do wonder, though, if the one thing you've said, Jonathan, that gives that I'm thinking, maybe this is the message, that is when you talk about the elite making white people, working class and poor white people, disposable. Because I think this idea, the contract is, we rich white people are going to pay you the psychological wage, using Du Bois's term, of whiteness by continuing to maintain your superiority over people of color in various ways. You may feel some toll from it. You know, it may be that you're not paid as much, you don't have health care, your schools are bad, but you still get to be white, you know. But it's still a story of those people at the top are still paying something. And when you put it in terms of, no, actually they're not paying something to you, they're using you, they're exploiting you, you are disposable to them. I wonder if that might be a way of getting white people to see that their, you know, their enemy are these elite people who, you know, because I think about Trump, but even if you supported his racist policies because you don't want people of color, you don't want the Mexican immigrants, you don't want black people to get any benefits, can't you see that what he's doing is just making himself rich? Like, that's to me, the most common explanation is not, it's not really racism, it's self-financial interest of the elite. Mm-hmm. And whatever it takes, whether it's racist policies, whether it's lies, you know, whether it's collusion with the Russian, you know, whatever it is, whatever it takes, they're going to enrich themselves. And I've wondered, like, even if you agree with his racist policies, don't you care that he's just enriching himself? And maybe I don't know. No, I don't know, but it's a kind of a different take on the idea of the contract. You know, the contract isn't as good. It's really not. It's not getting you even the little bit of that you thought it was getting you. It's really just making wealthy white men richer.
I mean, it's so hard. And I'll answer this maybe, and then we can open up for a big conversation with the audience here. But I would say this issue of, I mean, so for people who have read Du Bois's work on Reconstruction, that is the point.
Yeah.
It, basically, his point is, why are white people falling for this?
Yeah.
Because if they joined forces with newly freed slaves, think of all the things they could extract from elites. They could extract land. They could extract better working conditions. They could money, all these kind of things. It would be a powerful, powerful force.
Yeah.
So it's this idea of race, and Du Bois was like, we just fought the whole Civil War over this idiotic idea of race. Haven't we moved past it? Isn't that the sign of an advanced society, is that you move past this? But it turns out, no. Mm-hmm. The color line is very powerful. But this idea of, I mean, two parts about that. One is about, this is also a very corporate constructed message.
Yeah.
And I say that because I did also see in doing this research how much, I mean, there were moments even in the focus groups, even when I went to the NRA meetings and stuff like that, where I could see some vapors of some kind of agreement. You know, mm-hmm. people who were in camo with AR-15s would say, gosh, you know, when I think about it, we shouldn't have guns around kids, and what's wrong with a background check? And I would be like, wait, that's not your thing. And they'd be like, yeah, you know, a lot of us talk about it, but whatever. And the GOP has been so successful at constructing these ideas as either you're this or you're that. That this is an identity. Your identity is you're pro-gun, you don't give an inch, or something like that. And so people benefit financially from keeping us polarized in a way. And, you know, I showed some gun ads today that talked about guns. And it just said, restore the balance of white male power.
Yeah.
That was the ad, supremacy. So there's a whole industry of people making tons of money by keeping us polarized. And that's led to this system where we only have two choices. And it's like, either you're this or you're that. And there's no middle ground. It's like, oh, I can't be this and that, you know? Mm-hmm. So polarization itself is a sign of this financial system in which you have to vote or something like that. And of course, we can go back very far in history. Like just the whole category of whiteness in the 17th century was invented because of white supremacy.
Right.
So
so
as the world expert sitting to my right has written an entire book about. And so, but I mean, it's just funny because I kept thinking like, God, haven't we figured this out by now? And
no.
So I think that's part of the thing is just how effective it is. Now that being said, the one ray of hope, and I didn't get to it because I blabbed on a lot today in Soch. But I do think no matter how you feel about it, the fact that like Bernie Sanders is doing these progressive town halls with Trump supporters and stuff like that, if there's going to be a crack in the facade, it's going to be because of a progressive conservatism. It's not going to be about liberals telling people what to do. It's going to be about some possibility of this alliance that we've been waiting for. I don't know. But again, you know, I saw people who were very, very bad off, and they still weren't entertaining it. But I think that message, you're getting screwed or something like that. But it has to come from them. I mean,
you're not only you're getting screwed, but you're disposable.
Yeah.
You're disposable.
You're disposable. And not only are you disposable, you the whiteness isn't even making you feel better, because I'm thinking about all the people committing suicide.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, because if your whiteness is not even making you feel better, even though you're poor and broke or whatever is happening to you, then what is the point? Because even whiteness doesn't keep you there.
Yeah.
And this is what's so intriguing to me, is that the people you talk about who are committing suicide and all this, that's like a whole nother thing. It's like, so what is it internally that you feel so despairing? And I know this is probably OxyContin and all this other stuff, right? It's the drugs, right? But I do think it's really interesting that at the end of it all, that this is not keeping people in the space that they want to be in, because even the white supremacy, it makes them internalize some kind of self-hatred or despair because they can't be a part of what they think they should be a part of.
Exactly.
And they can't be a part of it. And you know, that's one thing. And that they're never going to have it.
Yeah.
You know, and that's the whole other thing. So even hating the other.
All right, let's get some questions from the crowd.
I wanted to pick up on the Jonathan, you mentioned, hi, I'm Kevin. You mentioned other models of whiteness and recovery, but from my understanding, that this is what whiteness is. Like what you have described, it's always been this contract from the get-go, and so it seems what is needed is rejection of whiteness, and that would mean, as you've sort of ended with, like in citing Du Bois, is the or as Dorothy has put it, is like hitching your cart up with, you know, the people of color and those who are more dispossessed and not the rich folk. And so I guess, but the ways is then, how do we promote that, I suppose? And also, I'm a bit, being a person from Arkansas, but being sort of overeducated on the West Coast and now living in the East Coast, I've always been quite sensitive to the emphasis on the South, the American heartland, as being like where the racist really these things happening, and the liberal coast is the promised land, but when you were talking, I kept thinking, well, it's like here in Philadelphia, I feel like the schools are just like the health, white folks don't want their kids in schools with black people.
Boston had viciously violent backlash against busing.
Yeah, and so and these are liberal spaces, and so it's like they might not be dying of whiteness, but or they are dying, you know. And so, but maybe this is what whiteness does.
Yeah,
that's the end. The end point is might be death.
I mean, I agree, but you know, so in the book, at least, what I try to say is, I reject this us versus them narrative. In other words, us enlightened white people here on this, you know, educated, whatever, and them. There's no us and them, right? What I try to argue is that this Trump narrative is an extreme, vivid technicolor example of bigger ideologies of whiteness that are about white privilege that surround whiteness when I walk down the street, you know, and that are all about aligning skin color with privilege and what that means and its structures. And of course, we also know that there's no shortage of Democratic governors who dressed in blackface in their yearbook and stuff like that. You know, so in a way, this is an extreme example of a bigger story about white America. And just riffing off of what Dorothy said, this point about how do you make the point that that a collaborative society, I mean, everybody does better in a collaborative society. And she's got the data. All of us, the end of my book, I've got all that data. Mm-hmm. But we had the inklings of a collaborative project. We had a chance to get health insurance for 94% of the country with the Affordable Care Act. And so, in a way, that's the thing that's being rejected. But I agree with you that it's not. I mean, there are some extreme things, and I do think elections matter. You know, I do think profoundly right now. But I would also say that that there's a bigger ideological question about whiteness itself, and it's getting back to that question.
Yeah, I would just add that, you know, if you ask what does it mean to be white, what is the category of white? What does that mean? The only thing it means is people who are allowed to have the superior dominant power in a society. That's the only thing. It's because we can see groups that used to not be considered white are now considered white. Exactly. You know, Jews were not considered white. Italians at one point, not considered white.
We're backsliding.
Well, so that's interesting. Emma Green wrote an article, Are Jews White? Mm-hmm. Because white supremacists are saying, that, including those who had access to the president, like Steve Bannon, if you look at the alt-right websites, white nationalist websites, they define white people as people of European descent except Jews. Mm-hmm. Literally, I mean, that's what they say on their websites.
Yeah.
And so we know, we know that the category of white has meant who gets to have power, who gets to be a slaveholder, who gets to carry guns, you know, all of these. It means nothing else but that. So then the question is, well, what is, I think what you're asking is, what is a redeemed category of whiteness? I mean, I think that we have to be moving toward an end of these very concepts of race altogether that are rooted in a hierarchy of the value of human beings. And from the beginning, it was hierarchical with whites at the top, black people at the bottom. And we have to get to the root of that. Now, everything we've been talking about has supported a continuation of that. And I'll just mention one more thing in terms of the liberals in the North versus people in the South. Most of my work recently, which is pointing out the persistence of this biological concept of race in contemporary science, it's about liberal white scientists who are promoting the view that race is a genetic category. And I'm usually speaking out, you know, against white liberal doctors who can continue to practice race medicine, including undertreating black people for pain. Who are these people? You know, they are not the poor and working class white people in the South. They're people trained in medical schools who are practicing right here in Philadelphia and all in the North. And the researchers that are basing their research and trying to figure out what's wrong with black people and looking for innate defective traits in us, these are mostly liberal white researchers who are doing this. I'm not talking about uneducated, you know, poor white people in the South. So these ideas are not just held by a particular underprivileged group of white people. They're held by many white people of all socioeconomic backgrounds.
And you know, the average Trump voter, I think the average income was $74,000. You know, so
right, that's another evidence of it.
So even the base is a stereotype.
Yeah.
Joanna had a question?
Mm-hmm. Hi, Sophia. Do you think it's possible to dismantle these kind of policies without
white supremacy head on, because all while you were speaking, I was just like, white supremacy, white, yeah, like that's, yeah, what it kind of sounds like. And then also, even I like to think of like racism as a spectrum. Even if you're not like burning crosses on, right, on lawns, like, mm-hmm, you still benefit from it. And there's some people still are okay with benefiting from this system that like oppresses others. But then I also recognize that it's difficult to talk about racism and white supremacy because people are turned off by that. Mm-hmm. So I was, mm-hmm, wondering what your thoughts were.
Me, you.
Yeah. I'll start because, mm-hmm, I don't know if we can just turn this off. The way that I like to think about it now, because I'm a religious studies professor, is that it's going to take a big, giant catastrophe, right? But unfortunately, mm-hmm, sometimes when catastrophes happen, that's also when people get othered. So let's talk about 9/11, right?
Yeah.
You know, because that's a moment. But I do think that, you know, there's something we haven't talked about here, and I think it's really important, is that the role of the media in all of this. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and it's Fox News. And I would bet that, mm, if we did a correlation between how many of those people that you talked to, mm-hmm, Jonathan, were also watching Fox News on a loop, then we would see what the reinforcers are, mm-hmm, to all of this. Because, mm-hmm, part of it is about what are you getting reinforced. And the kind of work that I've been doing the last few years, at least since 2008, has been about people who are religious that are also like really invested in white supremacy, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. And many of them hear this reinforced in two ways, one from Fox News and two from their pastors and other, yeah, people that they listen to, right?
Yeah.
And God and guns. And I went to a Palin rally, I'll just say this real quick. And,
oh,
it was God. There were t-shirts being sold that was like God, guns, and babies, okay, which hit everything that the GOP wanted.
White babies.
No abortion, but white babies, right, and get your gun, okay? So those were three things, right? And that was all together. And even if, you know, and, yeah, I want to, yeah, tie this in back to Mr. Alabama, Arkansas here. I want to tie this back into Arkansas. You could be fooled and think about this, and you picked the places you did, and I understand why. But you could be fooled thinking this is just about, you know, the South or something like that. But these ideas permeate all across this country,
yeah,
and they get reinforced by media. They get reinforced.
Yeah.
Most of these people aren't reading, you know, the New York Times or Washington Post every day.
Yeah.
They may pick up their local news and all this, and they're certain kinds of ways that messages are reinforced. They're also reinforced by politicians who know how to say things. They're also reinforced by religious people. And so until those things change, this is going to be very difficult to steer the ship, mm-hmm, the other way. That's my personal opinion.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I tend to be a fatalist. Maybe, you know, I think, you know, Jonathan's probably more, you know, probably at least I would think at least you're a little bit more optimistic than I am. But I don't know that I'm optimistic. I really do think that it will take, you know, generational change and people, you know, if the numbers keep increasing on your chart about who's dying, you know, when white people are not dying at 85 and they're dying at 65 and 45, and we start seeing less and less older white people, then this is going to be a correlation. Sorry, folks that are over 50 in the audience. But I'm just serious. There's going to be a way in which the attrition is going to continue to multiply.
But here's the
that's
thing.
A problem.
Here's the thing, and I'll speak as an optimist. I'll give you two examples of why,
yeah,
I don't think that's going to happen.
Okay, please. I mean, I want to be hopeful. I'm trying to be.
Yeah. No, and I mean, I love peonies, I love ponies,
mm-hmm,
I love a beautiful spring day, so I'm not a dour person,
yeah,
for the most part, but I'd say the two examples of
yeah,
you know, is, thank you, I thought that was funny too, was the Las Vegas shooting as one example.
Yeah.
Like, here's gun policy leading to, mm-hmm, a bunch of conservative country music fans,
yeah,
getting slaughtered, right?
Yeah.
If there's ever a moment where it's like your mortality's on the line,
mm-hmm,
that wasn't a liberal school shooting or anything,
no,
like that.
No,
it was,
yeah,
country music, conservative,
mm-hmm,
country music fans. And even then, people, the data after that, people were more pro-gun
buy
after that and
guns,
stuff like that. So
yeah,
there's this this ironic thing where the worse it gets, the more ingrained it gets.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
but for me, but I really like the question a lot, because I think about this a lot myself, which is, what can we do to not call it we're attacking white supremacy, because we know that's not going to get us any votes. But how can we do something similar in that way? What would be a structural kind of change that might,
mm-hmm,
do some of that work? I don't see this happening anytime soon, but polarization for me is a manufactured reflection of this issue. In other words, if you're maybe, I mean, I'll give you, I saw all these cracks in the narrative over the course of doing this, but also doing the media. I've done a lot of I've done a lot of conservative right-wing media since doing this, and I've done a lot of ministry television, which is huge, more than Fox, you know, huge things. And three or four times already, they'll be on and they'll be like, you libtard, Obamacare, and then when the when we stop recording, we're off. And then three times already, the people have said, what the hell are we doing going after the Affordable Care Act? Like, my aunt and my parents are on Affordable Care Act and whatever. So there's not a space in the rhetoric for what they're telling me when the cameras aren't shooting. And so in a way, I feel like, think about polarization. You're this or you're this. And there's no room for this, right? There's no room for that in a way. So recreating this polarizing thing keeps us from feeling like these problems are impossible.
But that's why I say the media thing is the problem, because the, you just said it, when the light goes off, they will talk to you, right? When the light goes off. But not while the light is on. But because they go off when the light, goes on, they got to make their money.
No, that's definitely true. And also, the two-party system is a problem. And, you know, I mean, there are also problems with just the structure of what this is reflecting that, you know, that I feel like, I mean, I never, I've been, just, until writing this project, I never thought about it. But now I think we should have a multi-party system, because I think it would let people have these hazy areas and stuff like that. So,
But that is optimistic, though, that if we think that part of the reason why there is this virulent investment in whiteness really surging today is partly because of the media, it's reinforced by the media, that might suggest that if there were a different venues like this, you know, different venues where people heard a different message, it might make a difference. Now, that's assuming, though, that people will can change their minds. And so you have to have faith in the in humanity that human beings can change. Even against the this powerful force of white supremacy and the contract with rich white people and racism that has continued for generation after generation after generation. But of course, I think the reason why we're sitting here is because we believe that. And I think we have, we've seen cases where we you work toward, it takes a long, long time, but a change in a message. You know, I've seen little examples of that, a change in the message. But just for example, my very first research project and advocacy project was arguing against the prosecution of black women who use drugs during pregnancy. And the whole approach to substance abuse during pregnancy as a crime. When I started working on that issue, there hardly anybody, there was the reproductive rights organizations didn't even see it as a reproductive rights issue, you know, and prosecutors all over the country were prosecuting people. The doctors were turning in their patients to police, you know, and then because of the work of a number of people from across lots of disciplines and lots of different forms of organizing, academia, as well as activists, the narrative began to change. And we did see states enacting policies that were more humane. I mean, that's just a little example, but it's an example of changing it. Same thing with in the foster care system. I'm on a board of an organization called National Coalition for Child Protection Reform, and our entire focus is on changing the message that children should be taken away from their parents and toward a message of understanding why families are struggling and don't have the resources to adequately take care of their children, and seeing foster care as a harm to whole communities and not a way of saving children. We've been working for decades on that, and recently we've seen a change in the media portrayal. Well, Brent Staples just won a Pulitzer Prize, in part because of the stories he wrote about the harm to black families of these policies. So, you know, there are changes. There can be changes.
We've seen change for the worse, too, so change is
possible.
We've
seen it. Exactly.
I was sitting here thinking that, you know, there's changes, but I do think that the one thing that really actually has to change. I mean, it's even happening with the, you know, with the point of the drugs and OxyContin, like now that they're starting to sue,
right?
But the one thing that really has to change is guns.
Yeah.
Because if guns, if we can get some attraction on guns, then I think some other things start to happen. Mm-hmm. I mean, even it led to affect healthcare, right? Because so much, I mean, if you think about Philadelphia right now, so much of what's happening here is about, and especially in emergency rooms, it's all about guns, right? And I know that's taking us a little bit sideways, but I think it's really important to think about what might it look like if we could get gun policies changed. And I'll give you one example of something that made me just think crazy this week. There's a guy in Texas who had to destroy, I think it was 75,000, it might have been more, bump stocks because they asked him to get rid of the bump stocks because of that. He's suing now because that meant that he lost all that money and he wants the government to pay him for the bump stocks.
Well, and the key here, of course, is going to be to watch the Supreme Court and what happens with the Supreme Court on these issues, because I think so. Let me just say we're going to get two questions. There's a gentleman, and then there's the headache specialist. And so what we're going to do is we'll combine those two questions.
We'll answer it.
I have three questions. Then I have a final question, and then I'm going to send Aaron out to get more booze.
despite referring to me as a headache specialist, I'm going to refer to my work on psychedelics. So I'm interested in this idea of a progressive conservative movement. And the reason why is because my research has taken me into these forums where people talk about psychedelic medicine. And this is one arena where a lot of white people are engaged. It's a very white space. And it's white people from a broad range of political ideologies and socioeconomic backgrounds. And they are not pro-regulation. Nobody there is talking about regulations in the way that your optimism suggests. The place where the left and the right are meeting is in deregulation. And where it's meeting is in their skepticism about the government. It's meeting around libertarianism, really. And it's meeting, and the racial tensions are actually, the white supremacy is actually where there's a lot of, underlying agreement. So there are these small movements where people of color are trying to get some movement and leverage there, particularly indigenous voices, because as you can imagine, they have an interest in how psychedelics are used. But they're a very small voice, not really struggling. So it's just from my observations, I've been thinking about what you've been saying up there, thinking about this new little world trying to emerge, because you do have a lot of people who would think of themselves as progressive talking to people, a lot of people who are very, very much Trump supporters. And I'm not seeing that. I do think that material conditions will get bad enough for change. I just don't know if it will be pro-regulation.
Yeah. Way to be Debbie Downer. No.
So I'm sorry.
No, I'm teasing. We're good friends. So I can tease her. But I think that's a really, really important point is, like, what are those? I mean, because if you think about it, like, what better? Like, Obamacare was basically, I'm going to give you health care and a bunch of stuff and save you a bunch of money. Like, what more could you give people? I think that's a very, very important point. Sir?
Yes, my name is Steve, and I'm a elderly white man.
You had hung in.
But I've lived most of my life in transitional neighborhoods. I'm about a mile from where my mother was born. I live in an only section of Philadelphia. Had mostly, in my adult life, African-American elected officials that represented me. In my community that I live in only, I'm a renter, live in a basement apartment. When we get together in our neighborhood, we have a lot of different people. We have Vietnamese, we have Chinese, we have Jamaicans, we have Haitians, we have all different kind of nationalities, other African nations represented. And when we get to talk at a street party, and we're talking a little bit politics, and when black people think as an individual, like the white person might think, some of the black people, and usually they're from Jamaica, or they're from the South, or from new African countries that have moved here. What I might call the traditional black community says, you are thinking like a white man. Who gets to determine in a black person what is thinking like a white man?
I would say not like a white person, but espousing white values, or what they interpret to be white values. So in other words, these same kinds of, you know, bootstrap things. You know, one of the issues that I always see, or I've seen in the past, has been people who have come from other, you know, immigrants who come to America, look at African Americans and say, why are you always on the dole? They almost say the same thing that white people say, right? Or somebody who would think that, you know, you get welfare, you get this. Why aren't you working hard? Why don't you have as many jobs as I have? So these kinds of things, I would say, it's not like a person, it's a particular kind of value. And so that makes the differentiation for me between the two. I've been working on Nigeria this year, and one of the things that attracted me to the project was that I met a lot of Nigerian Americans who voted for Donald Trump. Okay? And that was really tough for me, because I'm like, why? You know, and they were like, well, you know, he's rich, he made it. I think he's going to be a good president, blah, blah, blah. And I had to listen to that. That was very different. So they were tagging in on these same kinds of things. But I'm listening to you talk about your neighborhood, and I was thinking, this is one of the things about Philadelphia. There's these pockets where there are all these people who are together, and you have shared sort of things. And that's where the issue that we didn't really talk about a lot, class, comes in, right? Mm-hmm. Because it's a certain kind of social class and how much money you have and certain kinds of things that you share that may suppress some of these other things, because you're all, you know, you may all be struggling, you may all not be struggling, who knows? But you have some shared things in that community that bring you together, and I'll let everybody else talk.
No, I think that's exactly like a great example of this. In other words, I think the power of the Trump narrative is something to really pay attention to as we go into 2020, mm-hmm. because it's... I don't know, beside all this stuff, the power of you've attained something and somebody's going to come take it away from you, yeah. is incredibly, incredibly infectious, right? The minute you start mistrusting people, that's why guns are an important symbol, but other things as well. So this idea that you've attained some kind of status, and this happens in many ways across, mm-hmm. It's funny, I was thinking, because like, I was flying here yesterday, and I didn't get the upgrade on the flight. And I'm like, what? I have gold status or whatever. And I was like, and then I thought, like, wait a minute. Like, you know, there's this thing. And so we do this in a million ways, you know, a thing. So this idea of, like, some kind of status that we attain, yeah. that's under thing, people, it's a great way to scare the crap out of people and make them make irrational decisions. And partially that's what's happening in white America now, is this idea that you work to get to this point and it's under whatever. And so I think part of the issue is incredibly, I mean, it'll be interesting to see, for example, how many Latino and black people vote for Trump in 20, but I would bet it'll be more than in 2016, because of this idea of somebody's going to come take away your stuff. And I can say that in part because I'm a Jewish Midwesterner from a family of Democrats, from a community of Democrats, and now our community has been cut in half by this narrative, right. of, you know, so if you're peeling off like our community, I'm sure it's happening mm-hmm. across the board too. It's very powerful. Let's end on one last thing, then I'll force Aaron. I'm sorry, we're going to stop. Do you want to ask your question and then we'll finish?
I may not get out of here alive.
Uh-oh. Well, go ahead, throw it. Go. But make it quick, because, you know, he wants to get a drink.
Yeah, we've got booze, you and then booze. So.
The first thing is, I don't see anything new here under the sun. I'm sure you're familiar with it. I'm surprised you didn't mention Hofstadter's The Paranoid Style of American Politics. I reread it a year ago. There's nothing new. He describes exactly the Trump voter today. Isn't that right?
Some of us don't like him, but that's okay. But you, go ahead.
Go on.
I haven't heard any policy proposal in this whole discussion, anything that will ameliorate the situation.
Well, that leads exactly into what I was going to finish with. So,
but I will say this, is that, because I've thought about this a long time myself, I may be the oldest person in this room. I voted just I voted for John F. Kennedy in 1960. That was my first vote. So I'm probably close to it. what you see here, what's happening, and it's happened since the know-nothings and before, is it requires, call it, somebody of authority or perceived authority or respect that reflects the biases, hatred that you've got sitting there. Mm-hmm. And what you have today is you have a whole network which more people watch than anything else that reflects those hatreds, those biases, and every generation, that is key, seems to me. But,
well, let me say three things in response to that as we move toward alcohol. Number one is, we are guaranteed that you will get out of here alive. And so I'm guaranteeing this man's safety, because I think that was a really important question. And I'm really glad you asked about, well, you know, what's new? I mean, there are, you know, we could talk a bit more about that. But I would say part of the issue is, again, the power of bias, the power of these projections, all these kind of things. But it does present a particular challenge. And I guess the last question that I want to ask the panelists before we leave is just to end on some kind of note. Say you're a Democrat running for president in 2020. Mm-hmm. What are you going to do? So we know this is the diagnosis in a particular way. What's the responsibility, for example, of the Democrats when faced with this to counter message? I mean, I do agree with the question before, which is there some other way to combat white supremacy without calling it white supremacy? What kind of tack could the Democrats possibly take to combat this particular narrative? Or the other part of this is, what's the responsibility of white Americans who are aware of this dynamic and see it happening and want to push back on it? This is a question for anybody over drinks, or if anybody wants to say, anybody, AB, you want to say anything about that?
Well, I mean, I think two things. One is, if you're a Democrat running in 2020, you know, right now I think Elizabeth Warren is one of the people who has the most solid policies, but you need to convey those policies in a way that people understand them. You need to have bullet points. You can't speak, you know, at Harvard level, you need to speak about third grade level, because that's where everybody's attention span is at, unfortunately. And this is going to be really important. You need to get people to have buy-in to the fact that their material situations are not as good as they used to be, and that they don't have the buying power, and they can't do the things that people did 20 or 30 years ago for their kids. They can't, for a variety of reasons. But scaring them, they're already scared. Scaring them is not going to help, I think. That's one thing. So I think economics is going to be a way to talk about that and to say that there's a way in which we need to get ourselves back. And maybe the second thing about, you know, what do white people do? And I think about this a lot, because I think, you know, I don't think this is my job anymore. I think this is white people's job.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I'm real serious about that. I've been very clear that when I go out to give talks, you know, from a religious studies standpoint about all of this, that one of the things that I say is that, you know, you have to take responsibility for what is happening, and that this is not just an American problem now. This is a worldwide problem. And if you start to think about what this means when you go to Europe or someplace else, you don't have Brexit, you don't have Italy, you don't have what's happening with white supremacy in Germany. All of this stuff is about whiteness everywhere, okay? And it's all about whether we will let the immigrant in or not to let the immigrant in, you know, right? And is that person coming to take my resources and everything else? But the fact of the matter is, if you want your McDonald's hamburger, if you want any, if you want all of these things, these services that people can provide as they move up the economic ladder, then you have to understand that your people don't want to do that. And if you're not going to get on board with trying to see this as a collective, then we will all perish. Mm-hmm. And that is something that we need to really think about. And that third is your book, your whiteness, your clinging to this thing is going to cause your life expectancy to go down. And I've been watching this talk about this, and I remember when you started working on this book and thinking, you know, I hope somebody pays attention to him. But I think that this cussedness that people have right now will not allow them to see the gravity of the situation that they are in, because they want to hold on to what they know. And this is the only thing that makes it feel good, but it also is the thing that's killing them.
You know, it's interesting being in this conversation. Last week on Thursday and Friday, I spent the day at Harvard Law School because Harvard Law Review had a symposium on prison abolition. And I was meeting with people, white people, black people, Latinx people, people from various backgrounds, because they had community organizers there as well as students. It was a historic moment, I think, for Harvard Law School, for Harvard University. And I was extremely inspired that day. Your book depressed me, what can I say? But that day, those 2 days, I was extremely inspired by a group mostly of young people, it was mostly students and young organizers who were working dedicatedly, committed to eliminating the vestiges of slavery and Jim Crow that continue in institutions, and saying we must abolish these institutions. We have to abolish prisons. We have to abolish policing in America. I would add, we have to abolish foster care and all the other institutions that we can trace directly from slavery that continue today to harm people in direct, horrible ways. And it was a group of cross-racial group of people who will be around for a while. They were mostly young, not in their 80s. Nothing against people in their 80s, but you know, it's hopeful to know that they're going to be around for a while. Extremely dedicated, extremely, you know, I mean, that's where my hope is, right? Extremely dedicated and willing to say our vision is abolition and installing a new society that will be humane and with equal distribution, that's anti-racist. And who knows, I mean, even they were saying, we're probably not gonna live to see it, but we're moving toward it. And so there are people in America who are working toward a radically different vision than what white supremacy has created in America. And I think it's possible. Again, I think that's why we're here, why we do this. Yeah, if we thought it was impossible, we wouldn't be working on it and keeping that vision, and then thinking strategically about what will get us there is a way to approach all this.